FM presents a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grandmaster's Palace, entitled The Architecture at the Grandmaster's Palace. This talk is delivered by architect Konrad Teik and is organized by the Office of the President.
Well, first of all, I think that I express also your thoughts about thanking our president. Unfortunately, he told me had to come to close up the series, but other duties forced him to go to Lithuania today and Estonia, and he couldn't make it. So, but we thank him for giving us this opportunity to organize these lectures. I was surprised, for example, I was surprised by the lecturers themselves, the first time in my life that they not only accepted immediately, but not even one refused. Usually, you know, you have to beg, go on your knees, oh please, and promise something. I don't know what it could be. But this time, everybody really welcomed. In fact, as not immediately that I spoke about a year ago, I think, with architect Konrad Teik of this evening's lecture, he immediately told me, yes, why not, very willingly. So that's also a positive aspect about these lectures. I hope that after these lectures, something has remained about our minds, because we all did discover in the past the Grand Master Palace, but we are rediscovering once more, and of course acquiring more information about not only the artistic, but also the historic and even the cultural effects that it had even on the population as a whole. So this evening, the closing up of the series is, as you can imagine, the architecture of the palace. And I'm sure that my friend, Dr. Konrad Teik, will sum up the series quite excellently, like all the others. Thank you very much for this evening.
Thank you, welcome. Thank you, Salvatore. I have to state immediately that the history, the architectural history of the Grand Master's Palace is an extremely complex and rather convoluted one. We're not going to find a neat, linear line or equation tracing it. I mean, here we have to, this is literally the repository, this is the seat of power of the Order of St. John for more than 200 over 250 years. So we're going to see a lot of changes, modifications. I mean, the whole thing is there's transformations in continual flux. It's a building like it's in continual flux. So that makes it a bit difficult to pin down, and I'm not going to try to pin down. What I'm going to try to give you is a number of insights. There are a lot of visuals, so if I get boring, at least, you know, you'll be compensated by the images. To try to give you an idea how this palace, which occupies an entire block in the center of the city, came into being. Now, before I plunge into the subject matter, I think it's important to put it a bit in the political context as well. Remember, the Order of St. John was both a religious and a military order. Now, that might sound something very a simplistic statement, which might be the case prima facie, but it is not coincidental that St. John's Co-Cathedral and the Grand Master's Palace lay almost side by side in the physical center of the city. So there is something, basically, about the dynamics of power, and Valletta as being the city of the order. The order having both a military influence, temporal power residing within the Grand Master, and then a religious, a spiritual function, owing its allegiance to the Pope, and the conventual cathedral, the conventual Church of St. John's, representing that. So the fact that ultimately the Order of St. John decided to have these two buildings almost very close proximity to each other, I don't think was accidental. I'm going to show at the beginning that the intention of the Order at first, initially, the Grand Master did not initially plan to have his palace here. Started off in a different location. I'll be talking about that. That's one aspect that I'd like you to keep in mind. Another issue is Throughout anyone studying this socio-economic political history of the order, we realize that there was always a very intricate and tenuous relationship between different protagonists. You've got the grandmaster, the head of the military and religious order. You had the bishop, the head of the diocese church, and you had, at some stage, the inquisitor, the papal legate. Now, all three of them ultimately owed their allegiance to the Pope, so they were serving one master, so to speak, with one common aim. But obviously, as happens in life and in the dynamics of human interaction, we're going to see a lot of these jockeying for influence and prestige and privilege even amongst these three main players, key players. And it is interesting that the way they set up their quarters, so to speak, was also had a relationship to space, to urban space. The knights had their base in Valletta, in Città, the city of the order. The bishop had his palace and cathedral in Imdina, and the inquisitor had his residence in Birgo. In fact, there were various examples. The most well-known case was when the bishop wanted to have his palace in Valletta. There was a lot of resistance by the order, who basically saw that as infiltration into the kind of into the territory of the order. They resisted it, and the whole thing had to go to arbitration in the Vatican, you know, who ultimately ruled that the mission of the church knew no territorial limits, and even the city of the order was also within the pastoral realm of the bishop, so the bishop was entitled to have his residence, although they made one proviso that they couldn't have prisons or anything of the kind over there to try to clip a bit his wings. So that is something which underlies this as well, okay? I just wanted to put a bit of context before I start going into the details of about the history of the palace. I have to move a bit because I have to control the slide, so I'll be shifting a bit around. Okay. What we're seeing on the screen here is 17th century oil painting in Greenwich, the Maritime Museum in Greenwich, which basically, obviously there's a certain degree, as with artists, a certain degree of artistic license as well, of the state of Valletta probably in the early 17th century, where obviously we all know the knights physically moved to Valletta, which would have been a very different place to what we're seeing even here on the image here in 1571. And so and there was obviously a great urgency to get, after completing the Ancien, the fortifications, to get actually the urban fabric up and going. And they made a lot of regulations, regulating not just the aesthetics of the building, but also in terms of putting time limits, how much money should be spent, how the land was going to be assigned. There was a Commissione della Fabbrica, so there was a very wide, broad way, a whole planning framework, how to get the city established within the shortest possible time. This is obviously as an aerial view of the palace as we know it today, with its various parts, and I'll be making references to this just basically to orient yourself. We'll be talking about obviously the main facade over here, overlooking the Palace Square, St. George's Square, the Archbishop Street. I'm just referring to this for the benefit of the non-Maltese speakers who might not be familiar with the urban form, and I'll be referring to this in other slides, the Old Theatre Street and Merchant Street at the back, and I'll be referring to this occasionally. Now, one interesting aspect is Francesco Lapparelli, the town planner, who basically planned the city, presented his plans to the Grand Master. And there are four of these plans. Here I'm only showing the fourth plan, the four and final plan, so to speak, of conceiving the new city. As you could see, besides the Ancien, the outline, I mean, there is also the grid pattern, which is quite fairly, if not identical, very similar to what eventually was built in terms of the islands. But Lapparelli, although having been an assistant to Michelangelo, was certainly an engineer, a military engineer, a planner, although one, I wouldn't say by any stretch of the imagination that you could say that he was a great architect. But he did try to jot down and doodle in a number of buildings, which we have to try to guess what they could have been within the blocks. Obviously, this is quite obvious. There's a Latin cross plan here, which suggests that the cathedral would have been the main church of the order would have been at the center of the city. But actually, the other large structure, which seemed to suggest that this would have been the residence of the Grand Master, as you could see, is located opposite, very close opposite St. James Cavalier. And as you could see here, there's some kind of bridge or link or arcade which is dotted. So certainly by this fourth plan, there is no indication at all that the intention was to build the Grand Master's Palace, certainly in the physical center of the city. Now, when the order basically, Pietro del Monte gave the orders to start moving, transferring from Birgum, which was the base of the order, to the new city. Well, I mean, new city, so to speak. There was just basically the whole enceinte of fortifications, and conditions obviously were very basic. But at some point, obviously, he wanted to give a sense of urgency to this project by actually, you know, physically, that the knights would actually move from what had been more comfortable base in Virgo at the time. Now, the chronicler of the order, Giacomo Bosio, okay, he narrates how on the 18th of March of 1571, when the order left Virgo and transferred their seat of office to what would have been certainly a very incomplete city, and it says that the Grand Master Pietro del Monte and his retinue of knights accompanied him to a location which was his residence, which adjoined the site of the today's same site, the Church of Our Lady of Victories. And translating what Bosio said, these were his words. I'm quoting from Bosio, obviously translated. To his new abode, which then consisted in a little hut made of planks, screened on the outside by a rubble wall, to shield it from the fierceness of the sun. That house comprised a small hall with two even smaller rooms for the comfort of this person. Certainly a far cry from the majestic, imposing, monumental presence of this palace today. So, the original plan, as conceived by Lapparelli, would have earmarked the site of the Grand Master's Palace on a location roughly or close to where the Auberge de Castille stands today. The reason probably being at the time it was considered a strategic location, being situated on higher ground within the city, and it was considered as well that, in fact, the street, which is today South Street, was referred to in documents at the time as Strada del Palazzo. Now, another historian of the order, Bartolomeo dal Pozzo, writes about the move of the Grand Master's residence to a more central location. Now, it immediately became apparent, probably the Grand Master del Monte had serious reservations, that this was not right, that this, the Grand Master's Palace should be at the center stage of the city. Didn't become blatantly clear, but he started making his first moves. When, as we could see here, the block, this is taken from Rogers de Giorgio, a city by an order, we see the first block, indicated as block number 5 there, where, as you could see, there is part of the site, almost slightly more than a quadrant of it, is taken by what was the first Auberge d'Italie. Italian knights first established, bought, acquired this site. Okay. Next to it, there was another parcel of land, another part of even smaller part, not a quadrant, bought by two other Italian knights, Raimondo and Giannotto Bosio, and then the nephew of the Grand Master, Eustachio del Monte, bought this corner site here. And there are all the dimensions, but I won't give you all the details of frontages and areas, but they're documented there. They're documented in the notarial archives. And this has been researched and published, so we're not basically discovering anything new, but we need to start from this point. And as you could see, he acquired two parcels of land, this corner building over here and another parcel of land over here. Now, at the time, the intention was that right through this island, this block, there was an alley here, which bisected the whole entire island, which would have been about 3 canne in terms of width, which would have been continuous as well, you could see, with the street. In fact, these are the two portals, the two entrances, so to speak, on Archbishop Street and on Old Theatre Street are aligned on what would have been, if had it been implemented, would have been this alley, which then was absorbed within the fabric of the building. The other part, the other almost half of this block was still not assigned to anyone, so it still belonged to the order. So that was the initial situation, so to speak. Now, Dal Pozzo, when he basically wrote as follows, the house that Eustachio di Monte, the nephew of the Grand Master, had been built in the center of the square, served as a palace of the Grand Master, chosen as the best one and more comfortably sited than the one which had been designated on the hill where today the auberges of Italy and Castile are. So from this Pozzo quotation, it is quite clear that the whole shift in mentality, basically, was about location, site, you know, being in the center stage of the city. And obviously, when Del Monte cast his eyes on this site, on his nephew's site, he was probably already had quite other designs as well, which eventually, obviously, would take place in a very short period of time, to acquire and take over the whole block, so to speak. Now, Eustachio del Monte, the nephew, had basically arrived in Malta 1568, so we're talking 2 or 3 years before this transfer of base from Birgul to Valletta. And he was probably one of the very first ones, a very brave spirit, to construct one of the very first buildings in Valletta by building this small house. Now, unfortunately, he did not live long enough to enjoy the fruits of his labor and vision, because on his way to basically way to Florence to attend the investiture of Cosimo de' Medici as the Grand Duke of Tuscany, he suddenly died in Rome in 1570. That's 1570, just a year before the actual transfer to Valletta took place. So what we have is, we have basically an empty house belonging to the nephew of the Grand Master, so it was a very easy temptation to just basically take over. The idea of taking over would have certainly been quite an attractive proposition. Now, obviously, when he took over, his first challenge was how he was going to convince the Italian knights to move out of their site. They had already been building the Italian auberge, they had already been spending money on it. Obviously, the Grand Master, being the Grand Master, could twist their arm around, but still, I would imagine that the Italian knights were also quite influential. We know that by February of 1571, so that's quite early, this is, you know, at the time, and same year, beginning of the year, when the transfer to the city took place, it is documented that the architect Girolamo Cassar, who was the most preeminent military engineer and architect of the order, and had been assisting Francesco Lapparelli in actually putting flesh to this skeletal vision of the city, he was given some kind of recognition, some kind of gift. It took the form of a gilt silver cup in appreciation of his services to the Italian Lang, for obviously embarking on the building of the first Italian auberge. So the Italians had also entered into negotiations to acquire the site of Fra Raimondo and Giannotto Bosio, to even enlarge their own auberge. So you could imagine, here we have literally, you know, it's a chess game in terms of who is going to end up being the victor, and I'm sure that both the Grand Master and probably the Italian knights were probably vying their final objective would have been to take over the block. Well, the Grand Master, being the Grand Master, what happened, Del Monte died in January of 1572. And it was up to his successor, Jean Lévesque de la Cassière, who was much more, even more determined than De Monte, that he would appropriate and take over what was then the one-story building of the Italian Auberge. So after very long negotiations, finally he offered them a generous package, made them an offer they couldn't refuse. Well, they basically had better take it. And this included that he would give them an alternative unbuilt site, which is the site of the present-day Italian Auberge, where they are, a reimbursement of the total capital expenditure, all the capital outlay that they had spent in building the first auberge, a sum of 100 scudi as some form of appreciation, compensation for the inconvenience, and a loan with very favorable terms as well to finance the construction of the new auberge. Then the next phase was to pressure them even further in terms of expediting the move, because obviously they had agreed that they would only move once, you know, the new auberge was built. And eventually Lacassière gave them 1 year to do so. That year expired, and like many time frames in architectural projects, they were still there, and he was rather quite impatient and rather haughty with them and said, look, you've got to move in temporary locations because I want basically to take over the site. And that's what actually happened. And Lacassière immediately got down to the, you know, to quite, you know, started immediately working on basically the extension. Now, so the Eustachio del Monte part would be this quarters. So what we initially had when Lacassière took over, we had basically two disparate buildings, which were not connected to one another, which would have been basically this corner, which was the Del Monte property, and in fact even the quality of the rooms, the size of the rooms, reflect the domestic scale of basically of what it was. And then the one-story building that he had appropriated or purchased from the Italians. At the back, basically, there was nothing. And he started by obviously trying to integrate the two together and by also building this large, what we refer to as the Sala del Gran Consiglio, the chamber of the Grand Council, was one of the first projects that Lacassière actually built. So he actually built the structure of this hall on top of the first floor of the Italian Auberge. So what we're going to see is there's going to be a lot of restructuring, alterations, amalgamation, taking place and different, in fact, something like, for example, the whole armory wing over there would only take place later after the beginning of the 17th century. So these are actually notes by my dear friend and obviously very well known, and we owe a lot to him, the late Dr. Quentin Hughes. These are his actual notes taken when he was preparing the building of Malta. I'm very honored that, you know, a year before he actually passed away, he wanted to give me these notes. He said that these should reside in Malta. These are his hand notes before he published the first book, which was in 1956, so now it's very dated. And here you could see in his sketches already, he's sketching away basically the combination of the Eustachio del Monte house, the various parts of the building, and also, remember, the facade as we see it today was very different. These two doorways were only built during the time of Grand Master Pinto de Fonseca, that is after 1741, 1743. Before, there was only one entrance, okay? Those wouldn't have been there. They wouldn't have been closed in by balconies. That all came much later, okay? It would have been probably similar to something like this, okay? Where here you could see these are two drawings, sketch drawings, in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, which were discovered by Dr. Albert Ganado, by unidentified Dutch artists. Could have been Schellings, he was in Malta, and he was sketching away how the buildings looked. So this was his sketch, and they seem to be quite realistic and loyal to what there was. And because you could see it, I mean, in terms of the attention to detail, you know, which basically seems to vouch against too much of a liberal artistic license. And you could see here that there is the portal with some kind of rusticated coins, one doorway, just some very simple slits, and this would have been the Eustachio del Monte house. And then you see a little jump here in the roof line where the beginning of the Italian auberge would have been, but you could already see that by this point there was already the building would have been built all the way till the corner with the Archbishop's Palace. You could see other things that are no longer there today. There's this fountain, which is today was displaced, and is to be found in the St. Philip's Garden in Floriana. And there is also the famous column instituted by Verdal, with the Verdal wolf and his coat of arms. But you could see that it is a building, a site. You could see also at the background what we refer to as Torretta, the turret, which had quite a long history and started off, it was already the beginnings of it in 1572-73, when it was used for various purposes, for coinage, for the mint, for storage, like a strong room. Later on it was even used as a kind of quasi-astronomical observatory with quite a couple of rather a bit of quirky characters as well taking over. So you could start seeing its metamorphosizing, it's starting to change. So it is highly probable at this point that initially the architect was Girolamo Cassar. Okay, we know that Cassar had certainly been engaged by the Italians to work on the auberge. In all probability, being a very close associate with Lapparelli, he would have been the natural architect to have designed Eustachio del Monte's house, given the connections with the Grand Master. And we can safely assume that probably even the construction of the ground and the Grand Council chamber, the actual structure that was added on by Lacassier, was probably also to the hand of Girolamo Cassar. In fact, we have a testimonial by Grand Master Lacassier when he's given what is known as the salva condotta, which is a safe passage, a certificate, a safe passage, when Girolamo Cassar was going to Italy, was going abroad to perfect his art of architecture and to be more a bit of the equivalent of a modern-day architectural study tour, and which seems to even support his authorship. It basically says, Ordinario architettore ed ingegnere nostro, our architect and our engineer, our military engineer. Li sette palazzi chiamati alberghi delle sette lingue, the seven palaces referred to as the auberges of the seven lungs of the order, il nostro palazzo magistrale, so our magistral palace, the Grand Master's Palace, è quello che più importa, ha disegnato l'Ecclesia Nostra Maggiore, conventuale di San Giovanni Battista, riducendola in perfezione, and also our great conventual church of St. John the Baptist, making it in such perfect and happy proportions. So, certainly, another important source would also be trying to interpret maps, cartography, maps of Valletta at the time. Now, a word of caution here. Obviously, cartographers sometimes took great artistic license as well interpreting buildings. You end up seeing maps with buildings in Valletta having totally pitched roofs, you know, and we know that pitched roofs are quite a rarity. And you have all kinds of, we even have maps with landfront ditches would become moats filled with water, which we know never existed, or a fully-fledged mandaraggio with galleys happily sailing in. So one has to be very careful. In fact, observations have been made that in most of these representations of these maps, and these are rather, I've selected a few maps, obviously. There are many other maps, and that one would refer to probably the authority on maps, Dr. Albert Ganado's publications and books. But if we were to consider some of the early 17th century maps, and they all seem to have one courtyard, that the palace has one courtyard. And we know that that's probably, it's not true. It's basically an inaccuracy. Probably there was this idealistic vision that obviously the Grand Master's Palace would have been influenced by Renaissance palazzi like Palazzo Farnese in Rome, Florence, the typical palace with a central cortile, with a central courtyard built on the ground floor with a piano nobile where you had all your stately rooms, the grand rooms, which are the main reception rooms on the upper floor level. So there was a bit of idealistic kind of idealism in interpreting them, and the truth probably would have been far less tidier and less neater than what we're actually seeing. In fact, even here, this degree of artistic license ends up in having a little theater, Greek theater, almost like Epidaurus here, like you have a little, a very neat, completed Madaraja. We know that these obviously were never done that way. Even the design of the churches have something very Nordic and strange. And this is a map by a speckled map dating to 1589, so it's an early map. So probably the closest and the most useful is this map, Francesco dell'Antella, published in 1602 in Bosio, which basically here gives us quite some interesting information. If one were to enlarge the center of the map, one could actually, here it's rather in shade, the palace, the main square, the main facade on the main square, but here we have the full facade on Archbishop Street. Notice that somehow there are three portals, there are three doorways here. There is already, it's built on two stories. You could see how the main facade where there is the Grand Council chamber has been built all the way to the corner and even turned around. You could see, conspicuous by its absence, there is no armory. The armory hall, which would extend the whole facade onto Merchant Street, you could see is not there. Even this quadrant, the corner between Old Theatre Street and Merchant Street, is still a garden, still a walled-in garden. So by 1602, we could see that there are quite some integral parts of today's palace structure which are still very, very absent. The torretas there, you could see the form of the torretas there. You could also see that there is some courtyard here where there is the Del Monte house. There is a back garden or backyard, and there is another yard there. So certainly two or three yards, certainly not one main central yard as imagined. And even in terms of the facade, here we have obviously the end product of over 200 years of modifications, alterations, and presenting this, which basically, that is why when you look at it, the spacing of the windows, the fenestration and the doors are not regular, and they're very irregular and asymmetrical. Obviously, it wasn't by design. This was not one preconceived design. No architect in his right senses, particularly somebody would have been imbibed on Alberti and Palladio and others, would have dared to just put windows irregularly spaced in that manner. This was always a process of, and there were a lot of constraints, making do with the structures that there were, adapting, shifting, knocking down walls, extending. So there were a lot of constraints. And the end product reflected that this was a process of iterations, of working as well on the previous structure and trying to improve upon it. In fact, another thing to keep in mind is that what we see today is we consider this as a palace with these very lavish Baroque, even almost Rococo decorations, with these wonderful frescoes of D'Alezio and Nasoni, all these vortices. So it has a very sumptuous feeling. It's a very luxurious feeling, which is very much in line with the image of the palaces of the absolute courts, sovereign courts in Europe. But in the earlier days, in the days of the late 16th century, from 1570 to the beginning of 1620s, it must have been a much more severe, far less decorative palace, without the decorations that we see today, without the lavishness. A lot of those took place in the late 18th, in the late 17th and the early 18th century. So it would have been a totally different atmosphere. It would have been much more Spartan, more austere. This would have been in consonance with the spirit, with the ethos of the order, an order that basically promoted celibacy, chastity, vows of poverty, dedication to the poor. We know that these values over time were relaxed to even greater degrees later on, until we see Grand Master Spinto in all his vain glory, as depicted in the portrait by Favre. So architecture as well reflected this spirit of the order. It was a much more severe structure. And this description gives us, this obviously is by Patrick Bryden. This would have been from 1773. So obviously at a later date when he visited. The palace is a noble though plain structure, and the Grand Master, who studies conveniency more than magnificence, is more comfortably and commodiously lodged than any prince in Europe, the King of Sardinia perhaps only excepted. The great stair is the earliest and best I have ever saw. So here already a level of sumptuousness. But if we go back, revert back about 100 years before, we have a description by another personality, Sieur de Bachelieu, a French knight touring the palace, and he presents us a totally different picture. The palace of the Grand Master is not much on the outside. It is bounded by four roads, and it is more solid than magnificent. The entrance could have been more attractive. Obviously, he was referring to a simple, probably, hole in the wall, not to today's Pinto's wonderful ornate gateways. The small courtyard at the entrance would look more like that of a prison, were it not that the view is brightened by the greenery of a very neat garden, which can be perceived through some arcades, but which is obstructed by four loggias. So you could see how basically the image, the impression is. Now, one of probably the main architectural centerpieces today is this oval staircase that you've probably had the pleasure to even come here to basically walk through. And basically it is something which is certainly unique in Malta, but described as a building, a staircase, built during the time of Grand Master Hugh Lubin de Verdal. So we're talking here in the late 16th century, okay? And described as such by Monsieur de Bachelieu in describing it in 1679, but we're talking here that was conceived in the late 16th century. An old-fashioned staircase to a better courtyard, down to a better courtyard, which according to the design of Grand Master Wignacourt had to be surrounded by high and low galleries in the manner of Italian palaces. But those galleries exist on two sides. It is merely by chance that the others are not there. This staircase is truly made for a person suffering from the gout. Basically, we know that Verdal was afflicted by gout. So all these romantic images of knights in heavy armor basically having problems going up rises of steps is basically all mythology. So for a person suffering from gout, who had to be taken up in a sedan chair to his room. The steps radiating from a single newel are 4 feet wide, which gives on to two very beautiful apartments. The hall of the summer one, where the Grand Master holds audience, is 60 feet by 36 feet, and it goes on and on. Okay? So these are views, basically, of this staircase. Very low rises, almost just 2 inches, the equivalent of 5-6 centimeters, so it's very comfortable to go up in this elliptical form. We could see here the head of the Verdal coat of arms, the wolf, dog with symbol, is basically the insignia. This is a manipulated photographic image showing you basically the turnaround. Very, as stated, old-fashioned at the time, a typical Renaissance stairs that probably would have been very much influenced by some of the stairs designed by Donato Bramante. This is Bramante's design for stairs in the Vatican, the papal apartments in the Vatican Museum, which basically has this continually helical ramp raising up with columns over there. So it's certainly whoever designed it, and we don't know who the architect was, would have had access to probably treatises, engravings of something similar, and Bramante was certainly one of the protagonists of the classical Italian Renaissance, and he would certainly have looked up these works. And this is basically a view of the upper part of the structure, the central structure, the central newel, combining basically its plan, the plan of the stairs being reflected in the roof, basically with the timber and coffered panels basically roofing it. Now, luckily, and as I say this, fortunately, this did not end up being a victim of Grandmaster Pinto's monumental ambitions. You know, Pinto probably was the one who did restructured most in this palace. This is a plan which does not reflect what there is today. One notable difference, as you could see, if you consider this, this is considered where there is the entrance doorway, which we all accessed to come here. So there was just one entrance leading to the main courtyard, we refer to, for simplicity's sake, as Neptune courtyard, the one we refer to. And this was the upper courtyard. And you could see here, there was some design here, you could see here, for a grand scenographic staircase. Now, if that materialized, that would have meant the destruction of the oval staircase. This plan tells us something very important, how even perception of the significance of a staircase in architecture has shifted from something that was a purely utilitarian function. You know, a stairs basically gets you from one level to another level, so it's a very utilitarian, functional, mundane thing that was tucked away and hidden from view, now became something to be celebrated and something very scenographic. And in fact, our most elaborate staircases, like the Auberge de Castille, the one at the Fine Arts, Museum of Fine Arts, some in the monasteries like the Augustinian Convent in Rabat, they all date to the mid-18th century, to 1740s, 1750s, when the staircase became a set piece, a sculptural set piece to be celebrated. So Pinto had kind of basically cast his eye, and luckily, fortunately, that was never implemented. There were other changes. We see these changes happening all the time. Well, by on the basis of a number of paintings, which depict basically the placement of the palace with its square in front. Obviously, I already made reference to the fountain and the column, as obviously having since then shifted and removed. But another thing to observe is that here, at a very oblique kind of angle, we see some kind of large doorway which is set into the wall. But even more interestingly, notice as well open wrought iron balconies. The enclosed timber balconies came rather late in being. I would say even in Malta, the concept of having a closed timber balcony was probably a Spanish import, a Spanish influence that only started to infiltrate in Malta by the mid-1650s, 1660s onwards. And in a way, you could see the enclosed timber balcony as like when you're in a theater, in an opera box, as something to basically look out and see the activities that take place on the street. Now, this as well is related to the socio-political context, that with time, there was much more emphasis on scenography, rituals, processions, pageantry taking place in the public realm. So these balconies, in a way, were stage sets where one could see and not be seen or not be observed. So they were, in a way, an extension of the palace, of the building, to oversee the public realm. So there is also, I would say, that linkage. You could see that they're almost identical in terms of, in fact, you could see where there is today the Hostel de Verdelin, which is still missing there. You could see that it's still foundations being built. The treasure building opposite. And you could see that all of a sudden here in this other painting, we've got a totally enclosed timber balcony on corbels. Now, most of these balconies have inscriptions with those stucco work on the corbels, dating them to the time of the two cotonneurs, the two grandmasters, Nicholas and Raphael Cotonner. Although Pinto, Grandmaster Pinto, also did his part by embellishing further and even probably extending further the closed timber gallery on Archbishop Street. And another Grand Master, I believe, Derridien, also left his mark on the other side overlooking Old Theatre Street. So all of a sudden, these timber, enclosed timber balconies became a symbol of prestige as well in the form of embellishment. And here, for example, this time of Zondadari, you could still see wrought iron balconies. So there's something which quite doesn't add up here. Notice as well the dictum, going back to the Commissione della Fabbrica, the great importance given to embellishment of the corner, il bell'ornamento, that they had to basically recruit a master mason to decorate the corner. Wherever the two streets intersected, the corner of the building, the palace, had to be given greater attention. So obviously, these, what had started off as the typical rusticated pilasters that Gerolamo Castaro so fondly used, copying the Italian Renaissance palaces in his buildings, now were further reinforced with a balcony loggia that wraps around and even re-emphasizes this, the corner rusticated elements that is part and parcel. This I put in, these are actually notes taken again from the Quentin Hughes manuscript book, where he actually painstakingly even measured, you could see, was measuring the actual dimensions and proportions and relationship of also one of the details of the rusticated pilasters of the palace, and makes a case that Gerolamo Castaro's work is very much this rusticated coins are a hallmark of his work. Although I would just have some bit of a qualm with the use of the word mannerist, and that's another subject. I mean, once he wrote a paper, he thought that the facade of the Auberge de Provence was by Gerolamo Castaro. The original one, yes, but that was remodeled. So there was a wrong pretext at that point. So we have these embellishments which are taking place. And it's interesting to compare, okay, where did these come from? For example, this is an example. Okay, it's much more ornate, much more decorative. It's a timber balcony in Seville, in Spain. Much more highly decorative. Obviously, there is the element of the arabesque. Here we're talking about part of Spain, Andalusia, that was under the Arab influence, Islamic influence. The idea of the mushrabiya, the idea of a lattice screen, like a jali screen with a lot of intricate carpentry and decoration where one could see but not be seen. Somehow, the kind of timber balconies we ended up with are a much more classicized and simplified version. They're not so just ornate, and even our architecture, when it matures to the full Baroque, is never quite like the Spanish Baroque. In the Spanish Baroque, it is sometimes all decoration that takes over the structure. But then you have other influences. So we mentioned Spain as being possibly the provider of the idea of the enclosed balcony. But then what about the decorative corbels, and some of them having very unusual, very strange positions and all kinds of postures here. For example, this is at the corner of the intersection of Republic Street with Archbishop Street, where we see this figure here who is basically being held on the shoulders of a woman, bare-breasted here, holding his hands, sticking out his tongue, so with a mask here, which is quite baffling in terms of trying to see where did these influences come from? What was the symbolism of it? And this is, strangely enough, it's on the diagonal at the edge. There is something, kind of grotesque and unserious about it, but strange. But compare it to some of the Sicilian examples. Compare it, this is taken from Palazzo La Rocca and Ragusa Ibla, the old parts, where it was quite common with a lot of artisanry and craftsmanship in stone that corbels underneath all, there were six or seven of these balconies in the Palazzo La Rocca, which all have these interesting figures and combinations and postures. Yeah, number of examples here, which, for example, this is another one. This is Palazzo Consentini in Ragusa Ibla, where we could see even this, again, bare-breasted figure, female figure here, as part of a corbel. So one wonders, could it be a Sicilian mason worker in the employment of the order, embellishing that, so another extraneous influence? You know, it's just an insight. I have no documentation to prove it, but it's trying to go beyond. Obviously, parts of the palaces, this, the facades, parts of this were rebuilt after the Second World War, which is much more bland, much more austere, and the only relief is basically in the center of the facade, where there was the entrance to the scuderia, or where there were the stables underneath the armory building, where we have this slightly curved, rusticated doorway with a balcony on top, an open balcony on top. Moving on again, and we come to Pinto. So Pinto had a major influence in all of this, especially immediately upon his election. Within a couple of weeks, he started removing partitions, walls, things that he saw as encumbrances and accretions to the palace. He wanted to make it a palace that would be sumptuous, deserving of the dignity of the Grand Master, something that would represent, you know, basically a new sovereign image. And he projected himself, as we see in that Favre portrait, as being like, you know, acting like one of the monarchs in a European sovereign court. So these are certainly his work. This is a late 19th century photograph. You could just have a look even at the gas lights here. And notice these stone benches. I'll make reference to that later on as well. And we come to these portraits. They look very military in style. They're very robust, very powerful. They give you the idea that this is impregnable, and this, you're going into a palace which is basically well-defended, secure, and of some importance. Doric entablature, the use of banded columns, the idea of having columns with alternate bands is also interesting. Who was the architect? It's not fully documented as yet, but where did the influences come from? Well, if we look at some of the Renaissance treatises, like Sebastiano Serlio, Sebastiano Serlio's treatises on his seven books on architecture were widely disseminated throughout Europe. And he was Italian, transferred to France, but his treatises were like pattern books. He had just one book was on designing portals, on designing doorways. For example, this is the design, just one design, taken from his Libro Straordinario on the 30 porte, 30 doorways. And here you could see the use of the banded order, the keystone. Another important theoretician, the French architect Philibert Delorme, used the banded order. He wanted to create a French national order, a French order, an architectural order. In the same way, there is a Doric, there is a Tuscan, there is Ionic, why not have a French order? So the idea of the banded order is as well by Philibert Delorme. We see it in Mondrian's buildings in the Magisterial Palace, where he adopts the banded order as almost a French symbol. Now, here is basically a drawing from Sebastiano Serlio, which is a drawing of a Roman building, a Roman gateway, the Porta Decumana, which is taken from his own Roman fortifications, according to Polybius. And this shows, I'm not saying it's an identical design, but the idea of having paired columns, engaged columns with banded columns, with around surrounding a central portal, sounds quite similar. Obviously, the superstructure is completely different, but the whole idea of having pairs of banded columns around the main portal seems to be intriguing. And again, extrapolating from this, in his libro, as a particular book, book 6, which talks about domestic architecture, and there are designs for un palazzo del governatore, a palace for the governors, a palace for the ruler. And this is actually a drawing of one of the elevations for a portal, an entrance, which would basically be fitting for a governor's palace. And again, we see certain similarities. If you could compare actually this drawing, una parte della facciata davanti dal Palazzo del Governatore, and compare it with the Pinto period Baroque gateway, which again is integrated. It's not just a simple doorway stuck to the facade, but a major surgical intervention, because he had to basically hollow out this oval elliptical vestibule, carved up, it's almost like a miniature chapel, carved up with, again, banded engaged columns, raising up with ribs to create this vaulted structure, so you could see that he was recreating a much more monumental access to the city. This is not just a hole in the wall now. We wanted to create an experience, a whole scenographic experience that any visitor on his carriage, on horseway, would drive in into the courtyard of the palace and basically witness and feel, you know, the experience of a sovereign palace. So now, through decoration of the various artists that obviously I'm sure you've heard about in the previous talks, this the whole thing is about pageantry, stage set, making something that is much more lavish and sumptuous. These are British period plans. Now, let's talk a bit just about the different courtyards. Okay, let's start with basically, we'll be talking about the first courtyard, what we refer to as Neptune's Courtyard, and Prince Alfred Courtyard. They all end up having British names, even though built by time of the Knights for different reasons. Okay. Neptune's Courtyard, obviously, is referred to as such because the bronze figure of Neptune, by John Bologna, basically came from what originally used to be the marina works. There was a fountain near where there is the Notre Dame Thalys Church, and governor, one of the British governors, decided to basically shift the fountain to the current site, and hence the name Neptune. And the courtyard probably would have been quite different. And we have a description in 1663 where Jovin de Rochefort describes the courtyard. Inside the palace there is a fountain, a most worthy ornament for a grand edifice containing the treasury of the religion. There is a large bird cage, a small garden containing shrubs and beautiful flowers, irrigated by the waters of fountains and little springs that also serve to amuse the many beautiful birds of different plumage that roam around. One must also not forget to mention the two stables, one for carriage horses and saddle horses, and the other for mules and asses. So basically it was a little oasis in this what was probably quite arid and harsh urban landscape. Some issues, interestingly enough, is as well the details of the facade. What we're seeing is we have an arcade with arches. Superimposed on it, we have this kind of blind, a walled-in arch with interesting motifs. Consider this. So the first pilaster here, the first part up till the springing of the arch, there are these alternate projecting rusticated coins, rusticated masonry. And then here on top, this upper part where there is the springing of the arch, from the springing till the point, you have an incised kind of molding creating a panel. And then on top, an incised molding which runs the whole length. So if you go back, again, if you look at Serlio and you look at the plan of one of the courtyards of the Palazzo del Re, as proposed, notice how there is this idea of a rusticated arcade level. We have rustications here. And notice how the pilaster in between, superimposed pilaster, has this paneling effect, which is almost identical. Notice as well how there are the two arches on top. So there are similarities. It is derivative. I mean, I'm sure that the architect who did this would have had to rely at the time, they would have relied on engravings. They would have basically tried to be inspired by similar works abroad and adapt them to the local context. This basically, again, if we shift now to, okay, other interventions, this is obviously a later intervention during the time of Grand Master Perellos, which is a fountain which is at the back in the arcade, so dating to probably 1712, thereabouts, a fountain basically with the coat of arms, escutcheon of Perellos in its full Baroque splendor now, a very sumptuous kind of Baroque. But we come to this plan by Luigi Brockdorff in the British period. And we have strange things happening. For example, you could see that believe it or not, the upper courtyard was at the time used as a racket court. Yeah, you have little uses on. This is a plan of it. And in fact, it is referred to as Prince Alfred Courtyard to commemorate a visit of Prince Alfred who was the second son of Queen Victoria, in November of 1858, and he even planted a tree there to commemorate his visit. Now, this again is a bit mind-boggling, because trying to understand what's going on in terms of structures. Well, obviously there are certain things which are a bit obvious. We know that the turret clock is certainly by Pinto, so the whole structure here would have been designed and built by an engineer or an architect commissioned by Pinto. But this part, the lower part, struck me as being certainly earlier. Possibly, it has a full Doric entablature. Now, I might be reading a bit too much into it, but an architect who was extremely fond of always putting a full Doric entablature in his works was an architect by the name of Francesco Buonamici, who was, remember, the resident military engineer of the order from 1634 to 1659, and certainly a very well-known architect even overseas. So, we know that that quarter, going back, remember that quarter I had showed you in an earlier plan had been unbuilt before the 1600s. So it must have been built during the first half, you know, towards 1650. And we have another clue, because in the doorway of the armory there is a bust of a certain knight from Messina, Balbiani, who contributed money to finance a major restructuring project around the 1650s. Could it have been that part of the structure that basically, not this, the long structure over here, that basically had been done during this time by Buonamici? Possible. This obviously is later. I won't go into the details of the clock because it will deviate us. But even the other facades, this part, is probably the latest addition before the knights left. This was certainly contemporary with the time when the biblioteca was being built, the 1780s. The decoration, the elements here, they are all very verging on the neoclassical, the late Baroque. And if you were to look at the aerial view, I don't have the bravery to go 30 slides backwards, but maybe we'll say it, there is that part of the facade basically projects above the rest. Trust me on that. So it seems to have been totally, what was there before was remodeled and rebuilt, probably by Stefano Ittar when he was doing his biblioteca, the arcades underneath, and then basically took this down, took the whole wall down and redesigned it with these gates which have slightly kind of very classical overtones, very kind of classical, neoclassical motifs, with this balcony, which is projecting towards the center, but also the portals. Well, this is certainly Ittar as part of the biblioteca, where I have the main portal, the side portal opening on Old Theater Street, with this stylized scallop shell and these vaults which are integrated. Notice as well elements, these windows, very neoclassical elements, certainly Grecian meander pattern here, frieze, is definitely Ittar neoclassical. So this part of that wall would have been parts, a continuation of the whole biblioteca project. Even some of the facades, the details, I took these when they're still restoring part of this. If you compare, this is a window on the side of the palace, Grandmaster's Palace, in that part, and compare it with some of the detailing of the windows on the nearby biblioteca. The ram's heads, the oxen heads, well, I mean, it's as they would say, a no-brainer. It's certainly Ittar who would have designed that. So I haven't done archival research, but, you know, I would be very intrigued to see, probably there is somewhere documented it in there, that basically Ittar had a hand in that. So even within the whole smaller courtyard, there are so many hands here. There is what could possibly be Buonamici. We know Pinto in 1740s. Later on, 1780s, this whole wall was rebuilt. So we see this happening time and time again. Now, let's, okay, concentrate a bit now on the interiors. Once one proceeds, and the most interesting spaces, as usual is the case, are all on the Piano Nobile 11, as is quite the case in all Renaissance palaces. The piano nobile level is where you have all the stately rooms and buildings for receptions, for convening the council meetings, so it is quite expected. Well, there are three main corridors. You have the armory corridor, so this is the oval tower, the oval staircase, and stretching from the oval staircase all the way here to the portal where there used to be the armory, and today there is the Chamber of Parliament. Parallel to it, which is not indicated in this cutout, there would be the Prince of Wales corridor. The shorter corridor here, linking the two, is the, referred to as the entrance corridor. At the back, there used to be another corridor, which was later built up with a number of rooms that basically infringed, encroached upon the corridor. Now, as I'm going through the stately rooms, I'll just point out very, very quickly where the rooms are. This is, we're here basically, this is the Sala del Gran Consiglio, the Grand Council Chamber Room. Next to it, there is the, where I'm pointing, it's the room behind the staircase. There is the dining room, the state dining room. The tapestry room, where there are the goblin tapestries, is situated here, just at the beginning of the armory corridor. The presidential office, what was known as Perello's Hall, is in the Eustacio del Monte corner, the house. Walking from here, beyond the screen, behind this wall, is the ambassador's room. And then behind the ambassador's room is the yellow room, which is, or the page's room, okay? I'm not going to go into details, into frescoes, paintings. It's not my expertise, not my realm. I'm sure you've heard a lot about it. I'm going to focus mainly on one aspect. Obviously, there is the grand baroque vista. We're talking about a corridor 62 meters in length, 6 meters wide. The armory court corridor. So you could see the whole length, basically, of it as one emerges from the oval stairs. And at the very end, you've got your portal. Now, traditionally, it has been assumed or attributed that the portal, the design of the portal, was to the design of Romano Carapecchia. That is how it has been attributed. But I might be mistaken, but I've never seen any archival documentation or designs proving definitely that it was by his design. And something intrigued me as well. On the doorway, there is this bronze bust of this Fabiano Balbiani, who was this Messinese knight who contributed money to do this restructuring of part of the palace. There is a date inscribed here which says 1663. So if it was Carapecchia, it would have been much later on, and it was either how come the bust was there and was then later reincorporated, or could it be that the doorway is not Carapecchia and an earlier doorway? And I personally tend to subscribe to the view that it is not a Carapecchia design. Possibly now, again, sticking my neck out, it could be a Buonamici design, because Buonamici was an architect, a Tuscan architect from Lucca, who was a disciple, a follower of Bernardo Buontalenti. Now, Bernardo Buontalenti was from Lucca, was a military engineer, an architect in the late Mannerist phase. And if you look at this Porta delle Suppliche near the Uffizi, which is designed by Buontalenti, obviously it's a simplified version, what we have is we have a broken segmental pediment, becomes like a flying bird, a wing, turned around, rotated, and with a bust in the center. You could see that whoever designed this, obviously it's more elaborate, it's more, when this was done, this was late 16th century. If it was Buonamici, it would have been 1650s, 60 years would have passed. So yeah, but the whole idea is certainly indebted from the idea of an inverted broken pediment with a bust, is certainly inspired by the Porta della Supplica. Other things, that little scallop shell motif, if you look at the Jesuit church, which is by Buonamici, the facade, it was also very fond of incorporating scallop shells motifs. So again, interesting, it's an insight, you know, I might be proven right or wrong, we don't know. Then obviously at the back, unfortunately today it's no longer exists in this form, is the armory, what used to be the armory, which around mid-70s was then changed into the Chamber of Parliament, and the armory was, or what remained of the armory, was relegated to the stables underneath. So it was certainly, I won't read the description, certainly considered as one of the most sumptuous halls, armory halls, in the whole of Europe at the time, and the number of visitors to the palace basically attests to that. And basically, the other corridor, this would be parallel, the Prince of Wales corridor is parallel to it on the other side of the Neptune courtyard, where again we have a very scenographic, very baroque spectacle of quadratura paintings by Nazzoni, which I'm sure you've heard all about, depicting all the military battles and victories of the knights against the Muslim fleets. And changes brought about in the British period under Le Marchand, when even the original flooring was removed and replaced by this white and grey marble flooring. And the actual stately chambers themselves, very majestic, very spacious, the council chamber, the tapestry hall, which obviously owes its fame to the goblin tapestries that were acquired by Grand Master Perellos as his gioia, his basically his tribute to being elected Grand Master. There's a whole history about those, and I'm sure you've heard all about it. But I will just limit myself to one particular description of it by a visitor, a British visitor by the name of John Hansen, in 1819, when he's describing what he felt moving into the tapestry room. Remember, this was the room where the council would hold the order would hold its council meetings sometimes, and he described it in the following way: "I thought myself surrounded by living animals and human beings starting out of the walls, and as the subjects represented partook more of war than of peace, I was half tempted to unsheath my rapier in half defense. The scenes were principally in Africa. I could have dwelt forever upon the agony of a beautiful horse dropping beneath the fangs of a lion, the tiger and the wild boar, the elephant, the African chief, and in short, the produce of the animal and the vegetable world were here represented with such wonderful beauty that I could have gazed and admired them until midnight." This as well is a painting by Giambattista Tiepolo, which is found in the Sala d'Onore in Castello d'Udine, which depicts a deputation from the city of Udine who were in audience with Grandmaster Pinto and the assembled chapter in the council chamber. The state dining room, which was the place where as soon as one enters it through the oval staircase, this was the place where dinners, banquets would be held to diplomats, princes, other high-ranking guests. You could see the ceiling, the coffered ceiling is painted white with those gold pendants in the square. Again, a British period intervention during the time of Governor Sir Patrick Grant in the 1860s, when he basically removed the paving and put a rich marble floor. I know that this was also the case because I'm currently working on Emanuele Luigi Galizia, and in his CV that he sent to Riba, he mentions refurbishment of the state dining room in 1860s, so basically confirms that during this period he was also working on this. Obviously, in this wonderful setting, the Sala del Gran Consiglio, known by various names, the Sala del Gran Consiglio, the Grand Council Chamber, where the Grand Council of the Order met, also given rebaptized the Christians by the British as the Hall of St. Michael and St. George, as to commemorate the foundation of this chivalric order of St. Michael and St. George by King George IV in 1818. So all investitures took place in Malta, took place in this hall with this wonderful, the most remarkable cycle of 12 frescoes by D'Alessio, which depicts the different phases of the Great Siege. In a way, the Grand Master wanted to immortalize them in the collective memory of all the knights and of all the visitors to the palace, that the Great Siege would basically be always a historic point of reference in times of difficulties to the order and themselves. Strange things happen, and during the British period as well, it had the misfortune, as we see in this lithograph, that some misguided soul, could have been Sir Thomas Maitland himself, decided to cover them up and give it a completely kind of different neoclassical look. Sounds more like the Athenaeum rather than the Grand Master's Palace. And he got Colonel George Whitmore, who was certainly not very friendly to the Maltese. We know from his biography and for his account, even of his description of when he was working, we don't know actually his involvement was in the big and evil complex, when he referred to Sherrius basically being incompetent and knowing as much about building as I know about flying. But that certainly was a very kind of denigratory tone towards him. Yeah, what we see is obviously it got this very alien makeover, yeah, with this pastiche of azure blue and fake ionic engaged pilasters with chandeliers and mirrors, and which made it look like a Victorian drawing room. Fortunately, around 1907, a more enlightened British guy, the Duke of Connaught, basically gave instructions to remove everything, and with the help of Vincenzo Busuttil, who was the chief draftsman, the public works, the D'Alessio frescoes were re-uncovered. Beyond us, the ambassador's room, the state drawing room, also referred to as the Red Room, again with other sumptuous frescoes by D'Alessio. It also was not spared as well, some neoclassical touchings, making it something very eclectic with chinoiserie, all the wallpaper and decoration, which certainly was not in tune. And beyond that, what is referred to as either the yellow stateroom on the basis of the color of its yellow gold brocades, and or what was originally used as the room of the pages who would assist, would have the sons of the science of the most important families, noble families in Europe, who would send their sons to apprentice with the order, and they would be waiting and serving the Grand Master, and that was, in a way, their space where they operated on. What is today used as the President's office, formerly, that is, in the Ristaccio del Monte Wing, was formerly known as the Perellos Hall. There are countless accounts, you know, there's no way I can, you know, even give you that. I just chose one account that struck me in particular, account when Samuel Coleridge, famous writer, was here and actually worked in this building for a while, when he likened himself alone, living alone in this vast building, to a mouse in a cathedral on a fair market day. Although he describes his apartment as a suite of delightfully cozy and commanding rooms. Two other touches as well. Now we're in the British period, where you have got the palace, for one time acquired this deep burgundy red stucco color, which thankfully by 1897 had disappeared, and we have back our facade and its natural stonework. Something to notice as well is here there were stone benches. There were stone benches all along the facade and even on this part of the square, which were introduced during the British period. But then one particular governor, the name escapes me, he was a bit perturbed by their use or abuse by beggars, vagrants, drunkards, who would basically use them, utilize them, and to rest upon them, to lean upon them, and decided to basically remove all of them and basically repristine them and do away with these offensive structures that were causing him this inconvenience, so to speak. So, next episode. We're obviously now coming closer to our present time. The Second World War did not spare the palace. You could see that even the oval staircase suffered a direct hit. These are accounts taken from Hugh Braun, who wrote a book which basically is a report on all the World War II damage on the main public buildings in Malta, where he basically, as you could see on the slide there, he describes that the staircase, parts of it, substantial parts, were reduced to ruins. And as well, the building that suffered quite most was the Eustachio del Monte corner, so to speak. That also suffered a direct hit. You could see here, you could see Stella Scott House here written. You could see this corner part, which is the corner here, basically had to be rebuilt. And even beyond, even the part facing Merchant Street opposite the market hall suffered a direct hit and had to be, parts of the armory had to be pulled down and rebuilt. So certainly, it's a very long, complex, intricate history. One thing that we didn't have a lot of time to go into, but maybe, you know, just worth showing 2-3 slides just, you know, to conclude on this note, is also the importance of the square, the space, the urban space. Architecture is not just about the building. It's a building which is interacted with the public realm. It has no significance. This is not just about facades or about spaces. These were buildings, spaces, which were occupied by people. This is like a stage for the political, social events that were unfolding on the time. So we see it to this day, the use of urban space for celebrations, outpourings of joy, for riots, protests, for military parades, all kinds of uses in different atmospheres. And these are part and parcel as well of the history of the Grand Master's Palace. So I just at random picked up on two other images showing you as well this, this use of the space, space for parades, military parades, regimentation. Here, these troops at the end of the Boer War in 1903, and basically concluding here with a more joyful image as depicted by the artist Edward Caiwana Dingley of a carnival scene in Palace Square. Thank you.
I thank you very much, Dr. Teik. I may just make the point that, of course, he touched the building, but he cannot, of course, discuss everything about the palace. But I assure you that there is another, not palace, but another building, the same size, which is huge and enormous. I am still waiting the day when they would give permission to visit. And these are the undergrounds of the palace. I visit them. They are so huge, enormous at that times. They terrify you, to be honest. Unfortunately, some of them are, during the war, they try to make concrete with iron to make it bomb-proof. And it's not only bomb-proof, but as you know, the rust is coming out, so it's very difficult. But in any case, I am still asking the secretaries and even the president himself when would be the time so that everybody can also visit the undergrounds of the palace. It would be really an adventure to visit. Okay, thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grand Master's Palace entitled The Architecture at the Grand Master's Palace. This talk was delivered by architect Conrad Teik and was organized by the Office of the President.